Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Women Leading the Way Radio Show, where each time you'll hear from successful women CEOs, executives, and professionals, where we'll discover how they do what they do to be successful in business. We'll be interviewing women who have overcome big challenges, women who have incredible stories of lessons learned in dealing with adversity. We'll even interview women who have started and grown successful organizations and women who are C-level executives with unique talents and positions. Our goal is to bring successful businesswomen together to share how they're leading the way in business today.
Well, good morning, happy Monday, and welcome to Diversity, Serving Up Diversity. I'm really happy to be here, and I look forward to your listening to a wonderful topic today. We're going to be talking about the top issues of 2014, but we're focusing on wage and hour. And wage and hour workplace issues have been prevalent for many years, and they still plague employees today because there's still questions about who's exempt, who's non-exempt, who's a contract employee or consultant, when is paying overtime a requirement. And large employers find ways to handle the wage and hour issues. Now, that doesn't mean they're always correct, but they do handle it. It's the small and mid-sized companies that have no safe harbor, as there's no small employer exemption to most state or federal wage and hour laws. Well, our guest today works primarily with small, mid-sized businesses, and she's going to share with us how wage and hour apply. And she is C.J. Westrick. She's the owner of HR Jungle. She's an SPHR, a certified human resources professional, and she's been in human resource management for over 20 years. She started HR Jungle, I love that title, her consulting firm 7 years ago and specializes in working with small to medium-sized businesses who really don't need full HR staff, but they want a senior-level expertise. So with that introduction, CJ, welcome.
Thank you so much, Cecile. I'm glad I'm having the opportunity to be on your show.
Well, I'm glad you are, too. I hope you had a good 4th of July.
I did. It was very nice.
Well, good. Well, let's just get right into this. Let's talk first about who is exempt versus non-exempt, because that has been argued for years with different ongoing definitions, and there are some that say, yes, this is what it is, and others say, no, that's not what it is. And, of course, federal and state says, here's what it really is. So how do you define them?
Well, given the target of who I'm usually talking with, I have to try and keep it fairly simple. It is more complicated in the sense that the state and the federal governments have not given us true clear-cut definitions. They prefer to do an analysis and make their own decisions, so it's not as black and white as we might like it to be, and that makes it much more difficult. I think my easiest explanation is a non-exempt person, which is often paid on an hourly basis, is what I consider working more inside of a box. They've got the parameters of knowing what their work is, what their decision-making ability is, and they're supposed to stay inside that box, whereas an exempt person has more responsibilities and may often affect the bottom line of the company based on their performance. So it is intended to keep it at, you know, a much higher level, and with a small business, usually they've got much, you know, fewer employees that would qualify as exempt in the real world. Unfortunately, a lot of the employees even argue to be exempt. And so that's where it gets more complicated.
I know it does. So when you're dealing with your smaller to medium-sized businesses and they're looking for you to assist them in all these, as I was saying in your introduction, so how are they handling it, or what is it they need to really know in order to stay within the confines of federal and state laws?
I think the first thing is to realize that it's not really their decision or the employee's decision, that it really has to meet the guidelines that the state and federal government have set out, and they've each got their own definition
sure.
for it. And because I often get a small business where, oh, this person, you know, they want to work, you know, at home sometimes and work on things, so they work all these odd hours that would just be easier if they were exempt. And we don't want to have to, track every time that they need to take a break or something, so it would be easier. So they work it off of the ease of managing, or what they think is the ease of managing an exempt employee as opposed to an hourly employee, because they don't want to deal with the state laws regulating the hourly employees, the exempt, non-exempt. And that makes it harder for them to want to comply in the sense of that it should be just based on the responsibilities. And I know with this new minimum wage law changing the minimum wage, it's created a lot of other conversations, because I'm finding a lot of small employers that did have salaried people, exempting people, or at least I'll call them salaried because that's more what they were than exempt, but they weren't paying them even the minimum previously, and now with the new minimum salary required, it made a few of them have to change what they were doing, either to decide whether that position was in fact worth more money, or that they now had to break down and bring that person down to a non-exempt position, which can be, difficult also, because there's some pitfalls there.
Yes, there are a lot of pitfalls. And it seems, and you may agree with me, is that it seems many times when small businesses, or even some of the medium-sized businesses, don't really have job descriptions, they're kind of verbally telling people what to do, but no real job descriptions. And then they just kind of say, well, this is how much we're going to pay you, which may or may not only fit with the job description, but it doesn't fit with the legal requirements for wages. And it's crazy.
It is. I mean, a lot of the job descriptions I've seen are like 5 bullet points. And so you've got no knowledge of just how much experience or skill this person actually needs. It's just like, okay, here are the things. And then I love the fact that a lot of times the business will want to say, well, can I say that they have to work 50 hours a week? And, so often they're doing it for ease and for the extra hours, which are just everything that the governments say, no, no, no. And trying to move them to another direction and get it compliant is difficult. I've got some clients who have just decided to maintain the risk, and others that are trying to make the change, but if you've ever pulled somebody, where they've had a lot of misclassified employees and now had to reclassify them, they don't understand where the difficulties or expense may come in making that swap.
Yes, and it's always a challenge, and who knows what and who doesn't, And when we, there's assumptions, no doubt, from both federal and state wage and hours that we can't cover all today, but it seems that most widely some of the so-called white-collar exemptions are ones that I'd like us to take a few minutes to kind of address. If you will explain, because there's 3 categories, as you and I both know, and I don't know if all of our listeners do, but there's the executive, the professional, and the administrative. And I'm not ever convinced, and in my experience, is that employers understand what all of that means.
I don't think they ever do. I mean, the executive is probably the easiest, because it is more defined. It's like, all right, ideally that person is managing at least 2 people, and when I say that, it's not just being like the leader or even a supervisor, because I find often supervisors don't have hiring and firing capability, and the executive exemption, has that.
Yes.
To where they're doing the hiring, they're doing the disciplining, they're doing the firing. And so it needs to be somebody who is truly manager of those people, not just overseeing them. Professional is also a little bit easier, and because it's got a little more definitive rules to it, that the people have to be licensed or artistic or learned, and by that, they're looking for licensed certifications, that someone has been board approved by something like law, medicine, dentistry, architecture, things like that, that require like a state license to actually work your profession. And, also, we've got the artistic, which means that you aren't just a crafter and you're not just being creative, that you are actually making a living, being very creative in the sense of being able to, do work that is, I keep thinking, if you think of artistic in the sense of, people that are haven't shown anything galleries, that would be one thing, but it doesn't quite just mean that. And learned is someone who has a degree, a specific degree. And so it's, I think, very similar to the license. It's just not in a field that needs to be licensed. And so often, you know, scientific fields and these days even the IT fields are, you know, things that could qualify if people have gotten a degree in the field of study of where they're working. I see so many times, though, somebody's, oh, but they've got a bachelor's degree, but it turns out it might be sociology and they're doing other types of work, so it doesn't fit that. And so it does need to be that they've maintained kind of a straight line of their schooling versus the job. Administrative, I think, is the one exemption that is most used and abused. And because
it is
much harder, it doesn't have as many clear-cut lines. And so this one, I think, is the one that I'm inevitably having to discuss with my clients, is that it, again, needs to be, you know, work that's directly related to the management policies or general business operations. And it used to be, and I don't see very many of those, except especially in small companies, but large companies have what was originally considered the executive assistant. And that was a person who had the ear and the hand of, you know, the CEO. Now, you know, executive assistants, administrative assistants have become much more doers rather than deciders. And so that administrative assistant, I think, often gets put into an exempt level when it doesn't qualify. Office manager often won't qualify because they're not really making big decisions. And I've had this, oh, but they make decisions. And it's usually, but it's not big decisions. And so you're like trying to define something that's very hard to define. And that's where I always kind of fall back on, you know, okay, so if they made a wrong decision, could it affect your bottom line? And, you know, it's like, how much power do they truly have? And that's when I usually start finding out, well, okay, not that much. You know, they're working, again, kind of within the box. And but the governments are usually looking for, you know, people that are experts in their particular field of work, or that they're a functional department on their own, even if it's a one-person thing, you know, like often HR. If it's truly like an HR manager position that does all the HR stuff and, you know, puts new policies and or at least proposes them, stuff like that, that might qualify then for the administrative exemption. But if it's just someone else that's doing something, like you've got a facilities manager who maybe isn't really doing anything because the VP of operations kind of points out what their tasks are for the day, that person, even with a manager title, won't qualify. So it's tough. And frankly, you know, you do, if you're really trying to be compliant, you do need professional opinions on that. And a lot of times, you know, even the attorney, I had someone that had sent me a job description with like 6 bullet points, and it's like, okay, does this qualify? And it's like, wow. But I find half the time when people are trying to argue whether that something is exempt, it turns out it's probably not. And because the exempts, I think, are more obvious than what a lot of people want to think that it is. So it's an ongoing battle.
It is, especially, and you're so right in all those key points, because I know, too, when you're dealing with administrative, so often it's not defined what that means. And you're right. In so many instances, it's that administrative assistant who says, yeah, I'm a manager because, and therefore I'm exempt. And, you know, and I do these things, and yes, I sit and type and all, but I'm still managing other people. Now, in some instances, as you know, CJ, they are managing other people, but that doesn't mean they're supposed to be managing other people.
Yes.
You know?
Well, that's why I said a lot of times it lives into the overseer role. You know, they're overseeing something, but it doesn't mean that they're truly in charge of it. And, you know, have a budget? Do they have, you know, are they, you know, responsible for that person's performance to where their like performance review would be affected by that person's performance?
And I can remember, go ahead, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I think part of it is that they, again, it's usually just that they don't take it to a strong enough level. You know, is that person planning and recommending and negotiating and representing the company in that particular area, and as opposed to just being one of the worker bees?
Yes. And is 51% of what they're doing management?
Right.
you know, and so much of the time they're calling it management, but it truly isn't.
Right. They may be supervising that department, but yet they're spending 75% of the time doing the same work as the people they supervise. And but I know that, you know, frankly, if, especially in California, if the California rules on non-exempt were looser, we probably wouldn't have this battle so much with exempt versus non-exempt.
Yeah, I know.
That, you know, because I think that makes it also the reason when I hear people say, well, it's just easier this way.
And like, I know.
Yeah, only until you're caught, and then you won't find it easier.
and California is the toughest. I mean, all the other states look to seeing what we're doing in California and what works. And the federal government looks to see what we're doing.
So I know, and all we can hope is that they don't adopt some of the things we're doing.
Yes, exactly. Let's talk a little bit about overtime, because that's often where employers have such a problem, not just small to medium size, but all employers, no matter what size they are, depending upon whether they have a really good HR department or whether they just want to figure out things on their own. So let's talk about that. And so an employee is told they need to work past their 8-hour day, and depending upon when they come in and whether they clock in, whether they just come in, sit down, and start working. So what should that employee ask? Because employees don't want to ask questions, and it's always employers saying, well, you're going to work this, and this is all you're going to be paid, or you're not going to be paid. And the employees are always often afraid to ask any questions. But
we're trying to encourage
them to do so.
And it is true. It's like asking your employer, I think part of the questions they want to ask are, you know, am I going to get paid overtime for this? Or, you know, am I eligible for an additional break somewhere in there? And, or do I even have to work extra? but those are questions that I rarely will find an employee willing to ask. And, so it ends up more working from the management side of, you know, making sure your employees know. California put in the Wage Theft Act, you know, to try and at least let employees know what overtime was. But I find a lot of companies that are unaware of that particular document and act.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, and I'll bet, you know, there's probably at least 50% of the businesses in San Diego alone that did not issue new documents to people when the minimum wage changed, you know, for people that were at minimum wage. And so, you know, these are kinds of things that employees should know about, but in California it kind of tries, and unfortunately they stand, you know, jump up and down on businesses to force it on them, but they don't do it in a way that the businesses actually know what's happening. And because...
Yeah, right.
You know, if they don't have any system, when California puts out a new law or a new regulation or something they like done, they don't have any way of notifying all employers. And so you've got this whole group of them out there that don't have a clue that they're not doing something. And with overtime, I think the challenge is there. I mean, I've seen companies that don't know that you have to pay overtime in, you know, when it goes over 8 hours. They think that, okay, if the person works an extra hour tonight, I'll just let them go an hour early tomorrow and everything will be hunky-dory.
Exactly.
And I see employers that want to do that, and I see employers that will let them do that. And because they just don't know, and, I mean, I've had to teach several of my clients how to calculate overtime through the week because they keep wanting to do it to where it kind of doubles up the overtime. And because they know there's a daily, and then they know there's a weekly, and and their employers are saying, I'm automatically paid double time for working on a Sunday, period.
Right.
So, you know, it messes up the employers because employees hear things or believe certain things that may not be true, and then they throw it back at their employer. And it gets confusing. And so, it is difficult for a small business to keep on top of all that stuff and know, how to do that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and it's interesting when you're saying that, you know, sometimes they don't even tell their employees what, the minimum wage is. And I had a time when I was working with an employer, and I said, your employees don't even know, you know, for sure what their hourly rate is. And he said, well, you know, we have to buy all those posters and stuff, and it's written right up there very clearly.
You know, like anybody ever read the poster?
Yeah, exactly. And he said, it's not my fault because they don't read it. you know, I said, but then are you paying them what you're supposed to pay them? And he said, well, mostly. And I said, what does that mean? And he says, well, you know, I mean, I said, you're trying to say if they don't know it, if they haven't read it, then you're going to pay them less? And he just turned all shades of red. And I said, you can't do that. And you keep thinking, surely they would discuss that with their employees, no matter what size organization they are. But they don't.
No, and I think sometimes it's because they don't really know how to explain it themselves.
That's exactly right.
You know, they stumble with it. They don't know what they should say. I'm often brought in to, you know, even to help do the rollout of a handbook so I can explain different policies or answer the questions. And I think the downfall for small businesses is that they think if they don't say anything, they won't get in trouble. Because it's like, all right, you know, I won't talk about it because I don't really know the thing. And it's the old, if I open up the gate, then all these other questions will come in that I won't know how to respond to or something like that. But I think the thing that they forget to worry about is that if the owner, the company doesn't tell the employee what's going on and what the rules are, that employee will go elsewhere and ask questions. Now, sometimes it'll be direct to the state. Or sometimes it'll be their friends and they'll get misinformation or maybe even an attorney.
Yeah.
And I'm a big believer on making sure that employees have resources to ask in a way that it can come back inside the company and be dealt with. And if they, because if they go outside and ask something of the state, it could start, you know, an audit or a claim or something like that, to where at that point, then all the company can do is start paying an attorney to help fight it or at least able to respond to it. And so that's a very expensive way not to be communicating.
You're absolutely right. Or they'll go to the EEOC.
Exactly.
And
you know,
file
it's like
claims, the federal claims.
Yeah, because the state makes it very easy to file claims. Very easy. It's online. You know, it doesn't cost anything. You just, like, put in information of where you think you've been, you know, mismanaged or abused by the company, and the state takes it over, and you're paying, you know, thousands of dollars for an attorney just to respond to the state appropriately. And so I don't see that non-communication isn't working. And fortunately, because even business owners I've seen where, you know, how many times have you heard this, but these are my friends and family. They would never do anything to hurt me. We'd both be rich if we could get paid for that phrase. And but that also means that those employees, if they've got something that they think could be a question that they think could be perceived as negative, they don't ask the business owner because they don't want to ruin that good relationship. But those are the same people that will go out and, without any intention, start an audit because they'll ask those questions elsewhere. And
they certainly will.
So it's,
you know,
go for it.
It's so true. It's so true, you know. One of the other things I wanted to ask you and all are not only them working like overtime, at which point does an employer have to kind of stop that practice, or do they have to, of giving employees like say working 10 days in a row and paying them a certain amount of overtime?
They don't have to actually stop having them work like nonstop, other than the fact that they're going to quickly burn out that employee for in one way or another. But they need to recognize that they are going to be paying extra for that privilege. And because depending on how a company defines their work week, which is 7 consecutive days, so let's say that the work week starts on a Monday. So that always makes Sunday the 7th day. And so if the employees worked even just an hour each day up to Sunday and then works a couple hours on Sunday, Sunday will automatically be overtime, even though it doesn't go over the 40 hours. It's the 7th consecutive day rule. Now, if those 7 days, maybe they've got an employee working 10 days in a row, but it falls between 2 work weeks, then it's not going to hit. But I think, you know, the company needs to be aware of when they might have to pay overtime and when they wouldn't if they just reschedule people in a different way. And to at least, if you're going to pay overtime, to do it knowingly and, you know, with a plan that it really was necessary. There wasn't any way around it. And because it will quickly burn out employees if they don't get that break. There's a reason we only work 5 days.
Yes. At least I try to. What are some of the current issues in wage and hour law for California employers?
I think there's three things that I see most often. The misclassification, exempt versus non-exempt, is a biggie because you've got so many people just doing what they want to do with that rather than what they should be doing. The meal and rest break are still a big issue. Companies
yep.
don't know how to deal with it. They don't know how to work around the state's rules because the state is so specific with meal breaks and unbelievably, you know, rigid with that. And so that becomes an issue in certain companies. I've got one client that employees only work about 6 hours, just slightly over, but it's like nonstop, crazy busy during that period of time. And so trying to figure out, you know, get him into using the meal break has been tough.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's like, you know, he just can't figure out how to give him a break and do everything. And so that kind of thing. And then the rest breaks, everybody thinks that the Brinker decision a couple of years ago, took away all the rules. They didn't need to worry about it anymore. And it's like, that's not true. It just changed it or better defined it. And then the other thing is the comp time. You know, California doesn't recognize
mm-hmm.
comp time. And I
nope.
see that so often. They do, and I see it both with exempt employees where they think, oh, these people have been working on weekends a lot. So, you know, and they're tracking the time and therefore, you know, oh, so I'm going to give them a couple days off. And it's like, okay, you know, you start doing that. Suddenly, regardless of whether or not the person truly could have been exempt, you've just, you know, you're starting to make them look non-exempt.
Mm-hmm.
And non-exempt, you know, the fact that they think they can trade off working, you know, I'll work 9 hours today and 7 hours tomorrow and we'll be all hunky-dory as long as it's all in the same week. And California has makeup time, which can allow that, but it's got to be pre-planned and pre-approved. And that's rarely do I see them actually using the makeup time in an official way. It's more just that, oh, this is a general way we do it, or they'll even do it within a pay period. So it's like, oh, okay, as long as they make up the time in the next 2 weeks, we're good. And, you know, because they kind of think, well, the person's getting paid everything they should have gotten paid, but they just don't realize how strict California is on that overtime and how it can come back to bite you, because they always think, oh, well, you know, this is a great employee. We want to do what we can for them and, you know, don't make things rough on them. But what they don't realize is great employees sometimes turn into not so great employees. And if, you know, the employment relationship terminates and not on a good way, you know, that employee can be your worst nightmare. And, you know, and to me, it's easier just to know the rules and work within them. And, you know, there's lots of ways you can be creative with some of the stuff to make sure that your business isn't affected by all these crazy rules we've got in California. And but you really have to think through some of them and to find out something that will work for the business and, you know, make the employee still happy.
Right. Boy, I wish we could keep talking and talking, but we're just about out of time, because this is such an interesting topic, and I hope those who are listening can also relate, perhaps in your own businesses, what wage and hours and the like. But I really appreciate your taking time out from all of this. CJ,
well, again, thank
CJ
you so
on
much.
The program.
Yeah.
Sure. So, everyone, thank you. I hope you have a wonderful week, and we'll see you again next first Monday of the month.
Women Leading the Way is produced by Connected Women of Influence, the premier private membership organization where life-focused, business-to-business executive and professional women connect, collaborate, and cultivate a vast network of high-level affiliations, resources, and professional relationships. For more information about Connected Women of Influence, please visit our website at connectedwomenofinfluence.com.